This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yi Swu Heap. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
a state-backed news agency in Ethiopia reports that about 2,000 people detained during recent protests have been released after receiving what the report called education and counseling services.
That's Martha Vanderwolf reporting from Addis Ababa. Details next.
Also, Pope Francis has accepted an invitation to visit South Sudan, and the group Human Rights Watch has accused Nigerian soldiers of raping and sexually abusing more than 40 women and girls in camps for the internally displaced.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, a state-backed news agency in Ethiopia reports that about 2,000 people detained during recent protests have been released after receiving what the report called education and counseling services. While in Addis Ababa, Martha Vanderwolf looked into this practice of rehabilitation for opposition sympathizers. She reports from Brussels.
According to the Fana Broadcasting Network, Ethiopia's Minister of Defense, Siray Fegesa, told reporters that rehabilitation services for about 2,000 people detained over recent violence have concluded and those people have been released. Government spokesman Getachew Reda told reporters last week that the rehabilitation programs help the government deal with the large amount of people in detention.
Probably this is the only government in the world that meets out punishment in the form of constitution classes. So, I mean, some fitness exercise, maybe. It's only the most dangerous criminals will have to face the consequences really seriously. Otherwise, it's going to be rehabilitation programs. In 3 weeks, a month, you teach them constitutions. You teach them some values and ABCs of basic decency, if you will.
But international human rights groups have a different take. Human Rights Watch said in a statement Monday that rehabilitation is a euphemism for short-term detention and that these programs typically involve ill treatment and sometimes torture. Human Rights Watch says there is no due process or formal record of these detentions. The rights group says tens of thousands of people have been detained since anti-government protests began in November 2015. A deadly stampede and violent attacks on government buildings and foreign businesses prompted the declaration of a six-month state of emergency October 9th. There are no independently verified reports on exactly how many people have been detained since then. Opposition leader Merera Gudina of the Oromo People's Congress says hundreds of his party members have been arrested.
Mostly they don't have legal advice, lawyers and so on, and in fact, sometimes we don't know where they are detained. And it's not normal prison, you know. It's simply they are, for example, in Shashamane area, I heard that they were detained in cinema house. So they're detained anywhere, you know.
The protests started in the Oromia region last year over a plan to expand the capital city, but have since expanded to other parts of the country and to include issues of economic marginalization and political freedom. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Brussels.
Pope Francis has accepted an invitation to visit South Sudan. Details are being worked out and no date has been released. The announcement follows last week's visit to the Vatican by South Sudanese church leaders. The Vatican had asked about South Sudan's security and humanitarian situation. Daniel Dengbul, the Archbishop of the Episcopal Church of Sudan and South Sudan, told the reporters that Pope Francis will visit South Sudan in search of peace, healing and reconciliation. Tito Justin reports from Juba.
The Archbishop of the Episcopal Church of Sudan and South Sudan, Right Reverend Daniel Dengbul, who headed the delegation of the South Sudanese church leaders, told reporters upon arrival at Juba International Airport Sunday that he hopes the Pope's visit will bring peace, healing and reconciliation to the country. Archbishop Deng says Pope Francis was deeply touched about the suffering of the South Sudanese people after hearing first-hand accounts from South Sudan's church leaders about the ongoing fighting and human rights abuses in the country. Archbishop Deng says the Holy Father immediately accepted an invitation by South Sudanese church leaders to come and bless South Sudan.
Actually, our president, when he met him in Kenya, have invited him. The Catholics have invited him. Now, all the churches in Juba, in South Sudan, we are inviting him. The reason is that he's a man of peace. We need him to come at least to pray in our land here. And with that, God may listen to his prayers and all of us.
The Vatican has yet to decide when Pope Francis will visit Juba. Archbishop Deng says he believes the pontiff's visit will boost efforts to restore peace in South Sudan.
If Pope come here, that is the last authority in the church. So if the Pope could come to South Sudan and pray for us, and if the South Sudanese could not listen to him, then who will they listen to? That's the reason we wanted him to come.
He says the Pope conveyed his appreciation for the role the church has played in efforts to restore peace in South Sudan and said it's important for South Sudanese to resist the rumors and hate speeches that could further divide the country.
We encourage our people. We encourage you not to lose hope. We encourage you to come together. We are one people. As a church, we need peace in our country. We are one people. We don't need people to be pragmatic. And with this, we pray with you, and God will bring peace to our country very soon.
The conflict erupted in late 2013, 2 years after independence from Sudan. The latest deadly fighting broke out in July in Juba, which left at least 300 people dead and tens of thousands of others displaced. A week later, Pope Francis sent a message of solidarity to President Salva Kiir and his rival former First Vice President Riek Machar through one of his top envoys, Cardinal Peter Kodwo-Turkson, who spent 2 days in Juba shortly after the fighting broke out. Vatican Radio reported in November last year that Pope Francis held a private 15-minute meeting with South Sudan's President Salva Kiir in Uganda's State House during the papal visit to Uganda in November 2015. The Holy See Press Office said the Pope's meeting with President Kiir was private. Chapter 5 of the agreement to resolve conflict in South Sudan requires the transitional government of national unity to establish a mechanism including using faith-based groups or church leaders to promote national reconciliation and healing in order to ensure lasting peace. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
French police are verifying the documents of migrants in a Paris migrant camp as the government continues to try to get a handle on the migrant crisis in the country. Meanwhile, thousands of migrants have been moved to reception centers throughout France as the makeshift camp known as the Jungle in Calais was evacuated. Reporter Catherine Field is covering developments in Paris. She began by telling me about this morning's activity in Calais.
At the moment, Monday morning, we were still seeing clearing up operations going on in Calais. That was bulldozers, diggers going in to just move away some of the old wooden structures that were there. We still have there, however, these renovated shipping containers where some of the unaccompanied minors are being looked after. They're being housed and fed there while they're waiting to have their papers checked by the British and French authorities.
What are police saying about the evacuation of this camp?
The camp in Calais, they say now that is complete. They say that they have rehoused some 5,600 migrants from that camp, and that is the end. That camp will not allow to be set up again. That having been said, already over the weekend, you do see small encampments springing up along that coastline. So the big question is, of course, that yes, they have rehoused 5,600 migrants, but as the NGOs are saying, there were more than 7,000 people in that Calais jungle when police moved in. So what's happened to the rest? Still, it's unclear where they have moved to. Perhaps some have just moved slightly further along the coast. Some may have come back here to Paris.
I understand there was also some pushback by the migrants against the police during their evacuation. Is that true?
Yes, there are. I mean, what you have to remember with these migrants is they've been on the road for a long time. It's not as though these people just flew into Paris, flew into the airport here. A lot of these migrants have been on the move for months, according to not just the NGOs, but also the French government. They have come up through the Mediterranean. They've traveled up through Italy to France, right up here to Paris. These are people that have been on the road for a long time, and they're quite tough. So when they get somewhere, particularly here in Paris, they have camps, they have networks set up. Even though it's slightly safer and slightly, if you like, cleaner for them to be here in Paris because it's not so wet, not so miserable, they are here, they have NGOs giving them food, and they are setting up new networks here. That having been said, what the police and the Ministry of the Interior are saying is, no, this cannot continue anymore. If there are any migrants in Paris, they have to start being moved to reception centers in the Paris area.
Are these reception centers, are they holding up well?
We do have some 450 reception areas right across the country. So you're talking about from right in the northwest, up in Brittany, right down to the southeast, Marseille, Nice areas. They seem to be holding up quite well. That having been said, the main reception area here in Paris hasn't opened yet. That's not expected to be open until the middle of November. Certainly, they are hoping to find some 9,000 additional places at reception centres, not just in the Paris area, but across the country. So whilst the ones that took some of the Calais migrants in last week do seem to be holding up well, there is recognition that thousands more places do need to be found. And as winter progresses, the winter months are really just on the horizon, these reception centres will need to be opened up pretty quickly.
That was reporter Catherine Field in Paris.
There are rising concerns of hyperinflation in Zimbabwe as the government draws closer to issuing bond notes. The government is taking the action while the country faces a cash crisis. Officials have tried to reassure the public by saying the notes will be backed by a $200 million package from the Cairo-based Africa Export-Import Bank. Police have put down many protests against the government's economic policies. AFP reports the banknote plan received a setback last week. A German company that was scheduled to print the new currency reportedly backed out of the deal.
Tanzanian President John Magufuli is in Kenya for a state visit. A history of close relations between the two countries has been tested this year by regional economic competition. With the visit, both countries hope to align their interests. Lenny Ruvaga has more from Nairobi.
This is Tanzanian President John Magufuli's first visit to Kenya since assuming office last October.
Kenya ni partner number moja katika Africa.
Magufuli told reporters in Nairobi that Kenya is quite important to Tanzania. He said the Tanzanian Investment Center reports that 529 Kenyan companies have invested in the country, investing around $1.7 billion and creating employment for about 56,000 Tanzanians. The International Monetary Fund has stated that Tanzania is East Africa's fastest growing economy. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta said the countries will revive the Kenya-Tanzanian Joint Commission for Cooperation, JCC, before year's end to enhance investment and trade.
Safari hii ni ya kuimarisha huo uhusiano kati ya nchi zetu.
He says, and I quote, this trip is meant to strengthen the relations between both countries, end quote. He said, this visit is meant to emphasize that if Kenya and Tanzania are to succeed in expanding their economies and creating jobs for the youth, then the countries should, and I quote, walk together. Economic relations between the two states have been somewhat strained. In March this year, Uganda opted to run a large oil pipeline through Tanzania instead of Kenya. Uganda cited security concerns and said the Tanzania route was $1 billion cheaper than the one proposed by Kenya. Tanzania also won a deal to host a new railway that will connect the Democratic Republic of Congo and the East African coast. And just last month, Tanzania pushed the six-member East African community to delay signing an economic partnership agreement with the European Union, which guarantees traders duty-free access to the EU market. Kenya supported signing the treaty. Economic analyst Ali Kansachu of Nairobi-based Reach Management says this week is a chance for Kenyatta to recalibrate relations with Magufuli after a series of setbacks.
He scored some big wins against Kenya. For example, the oil pipeline from Uganda is now going through Tanzania. Big win on his part. And also in terms of the railway line, he seems to have prized away the sort of DRC connection. So a worthy adversary, somebody who's obviously very focused on the Tanzanian national interest. But given the current situation, I think Kenya would be wise to try and sort of reset existing relations, look at what can be done to increase trade and seek better alignment as the East African community and the markets open up.
According to data from the Kenya National Bureau of Statistics, Kenya is Tanzania's largest trading partner in Africa. Lenny Rovaga, VOA News in Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. 2,000 people detained during recent protests in Ethiopia have been released after receiving what the report called education and counseling services. Pope Francis has accepted an invitation to visit South Sudan, and Tanzania's President John Magufuli is in Kenya for a state visit. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The group Human Rights Watch has accused Nigerian soldiers of raping and sexually abusing more than 40 women and girls in camps for the internally displaced. Today's report alleges the attacks occurred in July at seven camps in or near Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State. A Nigerian army spokesman has declined to comment on the HRW report, and defense officials were not available for comment. However, President Buhari's office has issued a statement regarding the report. It says he is worried and shocked by the allegation. It says Mr. Buhari has instructed the Inspector General of Police and the state governors of the affected states to immediately commence investigations into the issue. More than 2 million Nigerians have fled their homes in the northeast during the seven-year conflict between Boko Haram extremists and the military. Yesterday, in related news, soldiers killed a man with explosives strapped to his body as he tried to enter one of the camps for the displaced. And five people died on Saturday when another suicide bomber entered a camp. It was the fifth suicide bombing attack on the camps in the past 3 weeks.
The U.S. Defense Department recently expanded its global network of drone bases in North Africa. The Pentagon has deployed unmanned aircraft and military personnel to a facility in Tunisia. They'll conduct surveillance missions over neighboring Libya, where the U.S. has launched more than 300 airstrikes against Islamic State fighters in the coastal city of Sirte. David DeRoche is associate professor at the National Defense University. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi asked him about the justification for the new drone base.
I think it shouldn't be taken as a major strategic shift. It's more of a tactical shift. You know, obviously there's fighting in Libya. Obviously it's of interest to us, and that means that, you know, we'd like to have drones on it. The range of our standard drone is about just under 700 miles. So, you know, if you draw 700-mile circles around things we're interested in, that's where the United States is going to want to have bases. And it just makes sense, given the situation in Libya, that we have something there.
But U.S. officials said the drones being flown out of Tunisia were unarmed and were principally being used to collect intelligence on Islamic State targets in Sirte, Libya, where the United States has conducted more than 300 airstrikes since August. What do you make of that?
Well, most things that are reported in the press as drone strikes, many of them are not actually drone strikes. Any attack from the air against an Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula target or a Daesh target, unless they can identify an aircraft, is reported as a drone strike. But a lot of them aren't. And the real value of a drone is in its ability to stay on target at a high altitude for a very long period of time, like 24 hours. So a drone actually makes more sense as an intelligence observation surveillance platform. You really only use it as an attack platform if it's an area that you just don't want to take any risk of a pilot being shot down, like Yemen or Pakistan. In many of the areas we operate on, the drones target the target, but the actual ordnance is delivered by an airplane, which can carry a much bigger and more diverse payload.
U.S. officials said the drones could be armed in the future if Tunisia gives the United States permission. Is that a viable option?
It's a viable option, but it's not a preferable option. I mean, given that most of the fighting in Libya takes place along the coast, unless the rebels have a very effective anti-aircraft capability, it would probably be more effective for conventional manned aircraft, which still have a larger payload and, you know, a pilot there actually watching it. It would be more militarily efficient if you acquired the target with a drone and then delivered ordnance with carrier-based or even land-based airplanes operating out of Sigonella or someplace in Sicily. That would still probably be more effective.
Tunisian officials negotiating the drone deal were especially worried that an eventual assault on Islamic State hideouts in Libya could send militants streaming across the border into Tunisia. Is that a legitimate concern?
It's an extremely legitimate concern, but let me tell you, Tunisia is at risk for that regardless of what they do in Libya. We know that at least in the war being fought in Syria, the Daesh recruits, that Tunisia is one of the largest contributors of forces, people from Tunisia going to fight with Daesh in Syria and Iraq. It's one of the largest groups of Arab foreign fighters. And these guys are eventually going to come home. So I think the Tunisian authorities are aware of this. Really, the only concern is how fast it happens. So some sort of action in Libya might accelerate it or might delay it. But at the end of the day, these are Tunisian citizens. They have joined Daesh, and they're going to come back, and they're going to have to be dealt with.
Dave DeRoche is associate professor at the National Defense University in Washington. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the electoral process and presidential elections in the United States. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
On November 8th, American citizens will exercise their right to vote and choose their next president. VOA is providing comprehensive coverage of this unique democratic process. Who is going to earn the trust of the American people to lead the nation for the next 4 years? Find out right here on VOA.
VOAAfrica.com. On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.